Welcome to This Week in the Warner Archive Collection, where we discuss our newest releases. I'm George Feltenstein, and I'm proud to be joined by my colleagues, Matt Patterson and D.W. Ferranti. Today, the Warner Archive Collection is back with two new releases on DVD for the very first time. Now, two may seem like a small number, but you have to understand that one of the two new DVD releases is actually a 9-disc set containing 34 episodes of one of the greatest dramatic television series of all time, Dr. Kildare, Season 2. Then we have 5 fantastic noir-tinged feature films starring Bill Elliott as a detective in the Bill Elliott Detective Collection. So let's get the discussion underway and talk about the return of Richard Chamberlain as Dr. Kildare. And we must note that Dan is participating telephonically today.
He's out on assignment. Where are you, Dan?
I'm deep in the steppes of Siberia looking for the much-rumored English-language version of Alexander Nevsky.
That's the musical version with all the musical numbers cut out.
With Leslie Howard and Victor McLaughlin.
There you go.
Did you find it, or is it frozen? And can you heat it up and still eat it?
I think I've been duped by the Russian mob.
Well, the Russian mob is nowhere in sight in Dr. Kildare Season 2, but Richard Chamberlain and Raymond Massey returned to Blair General Hospital for this second season of medical dramas, and there are some amazing guest stars in Season 2 and a very special episode, or maybe even two very special episodes. Gentlemen, let's talk about this.
I just want to start out by saying it was interesting now to come back to the Dr. Kildare series again after watching the Lou Ayres Dr. Kildares and the very special pilot episode that we saw on how the 60s series could have been imagined. So I just want to point that out in going into this because they each are a very special kind of Dr. Kildare.
Well, the original intention was to use the pilot, since we discovered the pilot for the Lou Ayres, the unsold Lou Ayres pilot, on the Season 2 set.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Then we realized it fit so much better with the film set since it gave full circle to Lou Ayres.
Right.
And with no disrespect to what they were trying to do with Lou Ayres, that would have been a fine series in and of its own. But the Norman Felton approach, he was the producer of Dr. Kildare, really made it the 5-season success that it was on NBC. And it only ran 5 seasons because Richard Chamberlain wanted to move on to greater heights, which he certainly did.
You know, after doing 34 episodes in a season, I would be starting to get tired too.
We've released some very, very episode-heavy seasons of television shows. I think there's 31 or 32 in FBI Season 1.
Oh, yeah.
And there were plenty in Season 1 of Dr. Kildare. But 34 episodes is a record
Epic.
For Warner Archive.
Epic.
But then that was not uncommon in the day. Shows like Perry Mason filmed 39 a year.
Right, and because they didn't really even rerun too many of them. I mean, that pretty much filled out the year.
They would rerun 13 episodes during the summer, or they would have a summer replacement series, and the show would go away completely, depending on what kind of a show it was.
Right.
But what makes Dr. Kildare Season 2 so special is the show is an established hit. It's come into its own. The characterizations are really defined. And as I alluded to earlier, we have some very special episodes. And the second episode, The Burning Sky.
Before we get to the second episode, I just wanted to point out something about the season opener, which I thought was very interesting for two reasons, one of which Dr. Kildare very much gets dropped into the neonatal unit, and he pretty much spends the whole episode within those confines with a new sort of supporting cast. And it even had elements of feelings of like somewhat of a backdoor pilot, and was interesting also was the head obstetrician in the neonatal unit was played by Stanley Adams, who, of course, is most famous to a certain set of people as Cyrano Jones.
Well, and it was neat because that was taking advantage more similarly to the old Lou Ayres movies, because each movie they would drop him into a different aspect of the hospital's business.
Right. I mean, it was using the full Blair General Hospital. Go, like, we can go to floor to floor to floor for a different kind of story every week.
You barely see the hospital in the second episode, Burning Sky, because that was a very special episode before the term very special episode came into vogue. We were remastering this series. All the episodes have been remastered from the original negatives. And when we went back to the film elements for Dr. Kildare, we were very surprised that the second episode was in fact filmed in color. And the Dr. Kildare series didn't go full color until its fifth and final year, when it was actually 2.5 hours per week. I had to figure out, well, why was this particular episode in color? And a little bit of research on the internet and various sites and newspaper archival sites led to the information that NBC, which was owned by RCA, who made color television sets, and NBC was the prime color broadcaster because CBS didn't broadcast anything in color and ABC rarely broadcast things in color. NBC really wanted to push the beauty of color by having 7 series that were normally seen only in black and white broadcast in color during their NBC Color Week. October 1st to 7th, I believe.
Do you know offhand what the other 6 shows were?
I know that one of them was Sam Benedict, because that's one of the ones that we own. There was also a show that I remember watching as a little kid called International Showtime, which was a show with circus acts, a videotape show. That's another one of the ones that was in color that one week.
Well, this episode, which was called Burning Sky, it features a lot of fire.
It was shot on location.
It looks
and
good.
And has a major guest star. And Carol O'Connor has a supporting role in the episode 9 years before All in the Family hit the air and made him a household name. But way before he became a mega movie superstar, Robert Redford, a very young Robert Redford, really shares the screen with Chamberlain for virtually the entire hour, as Burning Sky is an episode that takes place in the field. Kildare and the Redford character are remotely flown in via helicopter to a fire site. And it's a really well-acted, well-filmed, well-performed episode, and speaks to the general excellence in the writing and the direction of this series, which is uniform.
Speaking of well-performed, this is one of a number of episodes in which a very special actor has a recurring role as one of the other interns in the hospital. Matt, did you pick him out?
Gosh, no, Dan. Who was it?
Harvey Korman.
Oh, Harvey.
Way before he was the great Gazoo.
And you also notice that Ken Berry has a similar recurring small intern role on
Pre-F Troop.
Yeah, he was on for quite a while.
He was a little more competent in this role.
And then there are some incredible guest stars, most notably, in any regard, is one of the greats of filmdom. Miss Gloria Swanson stars in an episode that was a rare television appearance for her, and
was ready for her close-up.
She really kind of gives Norma, it's kind of if Norma Desmond checked into Blair General. She's a little less crazy than Norma, but not much.
No.
You know, you just don't get to see Gloria Swanson. She did occasional episodic television throughout the 60s and 70s. And variety shows and whatnot, but here she was
in a gurney,
Grand Dam, and MGM made a big deal about. She was supposed to make films at MGM, but she never did. So this was kind of a homecoming that never was, because they signed her to a contract in the 30s to do movies there, but nothing ever came of it. Huh. So this is Gloria Swanson's long-awaited appearance at MGM was in a bed at Blair General Hospital in Dr. Kildare.
We were also talking about episodes that struck us the most, and I want to throw out the Mask Makers episode.
Very important
with
episode.
Carolyn Jones, and she is a woman with a very, very large nose. And Dr. Kildare, who is working with the plastic surgery department that week, decides to suggest perhaps she should get a nose job with incredible results.
And this episode is called The Mask Makers, and people really didn't talk so freely about plastic surgery in those days. It was almost something as secretive as having an abortion. It wasn't illegal, of course, to have plastic surgery in the 60s as an abortion was in the 60s. But there was a terrible stigma to it. And the whole concept of beauty, the episode Mask Makers, really deals with it because she goes from being an attractive woman inside but suffering from the, you know, self-deprecating aspect of, oh, I'm ugly, you know, because the nose is almost like Margaret Hamilton's in The Wizard of Oz. It's a real honker. But her performance, and of course she's so beautiful.
And then she gets, you know, because we're more familiar with this story now, but it's great to see it acted out. But when she becomes pretty, she starts to resent it and resent everybody and goes a little bad.
As one does.
Yeah, and it made me think about, you know, I've got a big nose. Maybe I would, you know, get a promotion if I got a nose job. George, what do you think?
Well, thankfully, we don't live in that kind of a culture anymore.
Oh, but. Well.
If we're doing a little call out on the episode, I wanted to call out the season closer, What's God Got to Do with Julius, for a few reasons. I thought it was a remarkably sensitive portrayal of Judaism for 1962 for a primetime network show. Also, a really remarkably sensitive portrayal of the lives of the mentally challenged and the plea for deinstitutionalization, probably about 10 years before that really took speed in this country.
Absolutely.
And Martin Balsam.
And because sort of as the joke is, in the 70s when they do the very special episode, you watch it now and it's like funny because it's way off the mark. But this one, 10 years earlier, was very sensitive and it was actually a very human portrayal. It's almost like feature film quality.
Well, and every one of these episodes, not unlike we found in The Lieutenant, which again was Norman Felton as producer. Yeah. I mean, his work beyond The Man from U.N.C.L.E., which is talked about first and foremost when anybody mentions him, but he produced many series at MGM. Some succeeded, some failed, but all are of very great value and had an integrity and an intelligence to the kind of writing and performing that was just de rigueur. And Dan, that's an excellent point that you make about that episode. And we should probably talk about some of the other famous guest stars that show up during this season.
You mentioned a bigwig for Hollywood film. There's also a giant in independent cinema who is a frequent TV guest star at this period, which is, of course, John Cassavetes, a personal favorite of mine, Robert Culp. It's clear that Gene Roddenberry was a fan of the Norman Felton stable of actors because we get both Leonard Nimoy and Majel Barrett in different episodes.
Yes, and of course, a year later, he was making The Lieutenant. It's wonderful because the series has been gone from view for so long. We brought season one back last April, remastered it to a very wonderful audience response and people wanting more. Kildare, and if you read the reviews on the Warner Archive website or you read the reviews on Amazon from consumers, people speak to the quality not only of our masters, which we're very grateful for the remastering that Warner Brothers Motion Picture Imaging has done to make these episodes look so gorgeous, but to the quality of the television, the quality of the acting, the writing, and directing, which is not an oddity nowadays because I think we're in another golden age of excellence in writing and directing.
We come back to this again and again, that and what's surprising for a modern audience is how advanced these series were, how serious they were, because at the time, people didn't take television as seriously.
Right.
People didn't write about it as seriously as people do now.
This is the great wasteland.
Right, and these shows, you know, there are some people obviously who remember them for the quality, but this is such a great chance to rediscover the history of good television. I can't stress it enough how much you come to it and then you're like, wow, TV was good.
I'm just astounded in every episode by the integrity of Richard Chamberlain's performances.
You know, that was sort of the funny thing with Burning Sky is, of course, you know, one wouldn't ever think to look down on Robert Redford.
That's
but
so funny.
You know, Chamberlain kind of smokes him in that episode.
Yeah. Yeah, literally. We warn you, there are cigarettes in the episode.
In the forest
yeah.
fire.
Yeah, in the middle of a blazing
that,
forest
that
fire.
That kind of blew me away, because I thought it was going to be a plot point to lead to, but it isn't. No. It just put out the cigarette.
And by the way, in the maternity ward, everybody's lighting up. They're like, well, I'm having a baby. Like, it's just, nobody says, maybe you should put that cigarette out or put that alcohol away.
So 34 episodes of Dr. Kildare season 2 from 1962 and 63, 34 episodes on 9 discs, 8 dual layer discs, and the 9th disc to hold the last 2 episodes to ensure the best possible quality. We're very proud of this release and hope that the fans of Dr. Kildare who enjoyed season 1 will embrace it as we have. Now we'll move from the world of medicine to the world of the detective, or what happens when a cowboy becomes a detective.
This is a slightly different detective because he's not a PI. Well, let's first talk about Bill Elliott.
About Bill Elliott indeed. Dan, what is the history that you learned of these films and how they came to be? Because we've talked about this.
Yeah, Bill Elliott, you know, who was, you know, most famous for playing Wild Bill Hickok, which is why he was Wild Bill Elliott, still had 5 movies on his contract with formerly Monogram, now Allied Artists. And Allied Artists just basically decided to get out of the Western, so they just dropped him into this detective mystery series as a way to fulfill their obligations to him. But they actually ended up creating a pretty terrific quintet of mystery pictures.
These, again, they're programmers, but, you know, the characters are solid, the situations are solid.
The character he plays is such a different sort of homicide detective than I personally don't see that kind of approach to a homicide detective until Peter Fox Columbo.
That's
right. 20 years later.
And again, these are 5 feature films. It's the Bill Elliott Mystery
Collection.
He plays Detective Andy Flynn.
And I think it changes to Boyle.
And then to Doyle. They changed the character's name for the last 4 films to Andy Doyle. So,
because there was a real-life Detective Andy Flynn at the time who said, wait a minute.
That's
you
not
me.
You
used my name. But the films, we should call them out because they're each individual films that stand in their own right. And they're solid cop melodramas put together by the same creative team in most cases that were responsible for a lot of the Monogram Westerns and the Bowery Boys. It's a lot
right.
of it's that Monogram Allied Artists stock company of writers and directors, Ben Schwab and Elwood Ullman and Dan Ullman, and but most importantly, these films have been remastered and they are in the widescreen aspect ratio. You know, when you saw them in the motion picture theater, they were widescreen. They weren't CinemaScope, but they were widescreen. If you've ever caught some of them on television, and most of them probably haven't even been on television in a while.
Very rarely.
You would have seen, you know, a distorted view, 4:3. They've all been remastered in 16:9 full frame, so your widescreen television set will be ablaze with Wild Bill Elliott, not so wild, but as a Detective Andy. And the titles are Dial Red O.
Red Zero, because it's supposed to be the zero that was how you, like 911.
I know. I meant it as that, but that,
But people have done that. They have it as O, so like an IMDb, it's
but
under
I meant O for operators.
Oh,
so Dial Red Zero, but it won't be spelled out as zero. It's Dial Red, quote unquote, O. And that was the first in this series. And then we have Sudden Danger, which has a very impressive cast of Tom Drake and Beverly Garland. And then we have Calling Homicide, which is the next film.
Which introduces Don Haggerty as Sergeant Mike Duncan.
Followed by Chain of Evidence. And the last is Footsteps in the Night.
And I know that I'm totally interrupting for the most important thing, but what a hat he wears.
He wears, that's kind of cool. He traded in his cowboy hat
for
a unique detective chapeau.
And what I thought was really funny was what an easygoing homicide detective he is. I mean, at a time where, you know, you're used to thinking of the homicide detectives at this time being like, get the rubber hose, you're not getting out of here.
Or Joe Friday.
He's really pleasant. He's very nice. He's just really pesky, and he keeps coming back and asking questions until he's able to put the pieces together.
And that's where it's like Columbo. He's a genuinely nice guy, and he sees the good in people, and he gets a little idea in his head, and he won't let it go. And that's consistent through the series. Also through the series, what I love is that they start to explain, and when I moved here, I didn't know the difference between the sheriff's department and the L.A. City cops.
Right. It's the L.A. County versus L.A. City.
And it's like the unincorporated areas. So he's in charge of like the canyons and like the, you know, West Hollywood, which wasn't a city.
Right.
You know, the seedy, weird corners of the metropolitan area.
And the nice corners of the valley that
are
part of the unincorporated city of Los Angeles.
But they're just as seedy.
Now, in the first film, Dial Red for Zero, he is attempting to track down a vet who's gone AWOL, whose fiance has been murdered.
A veteran.
There's no ketamine involved in the story.
But he hops the wall and then gets probably at the worst time.
And, you know, it's an early treatment of, well, you know, this is before we had the term, but it's dealing with, you know, what was shell shock, what was combat fatigue, which is the psychological impact of war, and trying to be understanding with our veterans as they're integrating back into society. And this one veteran hops the wall when he gets a divorce letter. Unfortunately, his fiancée is murdered, but Bill Elliott has his suspicions.
Yeah, and interestingly here, the mystery, we know what happens in this one, but it's watching Bill Elliott pull it all back together and you know, make sense of it and going on his gut feelings and then twisting and turning.
It's, and in the later installments, we don't know. Starting with the next film, Sudden Danger, in which the suspect in a suicide is a blind man. Or was it the dog?
Yeah, and his mother is killed, and so, you know, did the blind man do it to get money for an operation?
Because it was the mother's fault that he was blind.
And they brought in a fun, you know, and this is atypical for noir, a sportswear manufacturing company. But I like those little elements because that's like
I liked the gratuitous swimsuit modeling moments. I mean, got to get people in the seats.
And it's interesting to see Tom Drake in these later post-MGM roles where he's far more gritty because we're used to seeing him from movies like Meet Me in St. Louis where he was the boy next door, or Scene of the Crime, which is a whack title from 1949, which is a great noir with Van Johnson where he's learning the ropes as a cop. But here he's just a little older and a little more weathered, but a lot more real.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's so cool about these films is they're low budget, no pretense, good storytelling, and five films fit solidly on two two-layer discs because these films all run about an hour apiece.
And a solid hour and great location photography.
Oh, wonderful.
They just went out and run and gunned it.
It's so crisp. And, you know, like, but what's fun is they'll be at, like, a hot dog stand turn, and I'm like, oh, that's the golf course, you know, that's still there where O.J. was once picked up.
And because we have remastered these pictures in HD, these are DVDs, of course. They're not high-definition discs, but the new masters are HD, which captures so much more of what's
the
on the film.
Detail.
You can read the street signs.
That's exactly what I was doing.
You can tell exactly where everything was filmed.
I went, like, on Google Maps. I was looking at that. I'm like, oh, wait, I think that's here, you know, because you see the street signs clearly. And I love Los Angeles historical shots. I know I talk about it all the time.
So there'll be a lot more coming from Allied Artists and Monogram throughout 2014 from WAC. But we started off the year with a bang in Bill Elliott, so it doesn't get better than that.
And we didn't even get to the black market babies, but you can discover that for yourself.
But, you know, there's, you know, Jeannie Cooper and James Lydon. There's a bunch of other people that
great
show up.
Great supporting players, all five of the films. And it's too bad they stopped with Footsteps in the Night. They could have gone on with this for a long time.
No, they definitely did. Unfortunately, he died it was 8 years later. It was,
yeah,
it wasn't
but
that
I think
far.
They were a company in transition.
Right, 57.
And trying to move out of the, they were releasing a lot of films. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Bowery Boys film series came to an end at this time.
Right around the same time.
They were trying to eliminate the shorter B pictures and just focus on A features. So less features.
Less
and
Bs.
Hopefully more box office. But
right.
Their results were hit and miss. And we're delighted to present the hits and the misses. But every one of these Bill Elliott mysteries hits a bullseye, and we know you'll like this collection tremendously. So that's it for the new DVDs. but we have new titles on Warner Archive Instant.
OMG.
All the time. They're being added, and Warner Archive Instant is, of course, our new streaming video on demand service where you subscribe for a monthly fee. You get hundreds of movies and hundreds of hours of television shows that are rare and hard to find. And you can try it with a 2-week free trial. You can view it using your Roku device or your iPad, your PC, or your Mac. And we're adding new devices, hopefully in the near future.
Let me just say that this month, we're still in January, there are going to be over 100 new films added to the service, which makes it very difficult for me to keep up, George. I'm blaming you for this. Because when I was like, oh, what's my instant pick going to be this week? I was completely and utterly overwhelmed by awesomeness.
Well, as we have transitioned and fine-tuned the site, we slowed down a little bit at the end of the fall. And now the well has opened again, and we're adding, in the last 2 weeks alone, 60 titles, and we have another 25 coming in this week. So there's a lot to talk about.
Yeah, if you haven't even tried this out again, it's 2 weeks free. You got to see it. And there are a lot of movies on the service now that we're not talking about, but that we have talked about. You know, in the past on this podcast, they came out on DVD through Warner Archive, and now especially these great HD masters are up there. Totally worth checking out.
And then you'll also be seeing some movies that have never been on home video in any format that may have shown up on television 25 years ago if you were up at 3 in the morning, but that just haven't been seen. And the master isn't HD. The master is the only master that exists, but the film itself is rare.
It's
and you'll
worth
be seeing,
seeing
a lot more of those kind of things in addition to these pristine HD masters.
We should definitely highlight those in upcoming episodes because there'd be no other way to really get information about these at all.
Right.
I was looking up one that's coming down the pike. We couldn't even find pictures of
for Captain Thunder.
Yes, that's
exactly
it. I
knew
exactly
you were going to talk about that.
Because that's been a real problem for
with
us.
Faye Ray and Victor Varconi. This is a 1930 Warner Brothers film that's not in the service yet. And it's virtually impossible to see, but Warner Archive Instant will have Captain Thunder shortly, but not yet. But by the time you listen to this,
it may be up. All right.
But we've got new additions that are in the service now that we're ready to talk about. So,
Dan,
why don't you start the ball rolling with your picks?
I sort of have a contiguous series, but it's all anchored by a sentimental favorite, which is a film I will champion and defend to the grave, which is the sequel to my favorite film of all time, King Kong, Son of Kong. Son of Kong is much maligned by a certain element who don't understand that it is actually possible to make a terrific children's film follow-up to a terrific film of all time. Robert Armstrong is great. If you watch this film and you don't tear up in the end, there is something wrong with you. Yes, the effects aren't as good as King Kong because they came out the same year.
That's
but they're
right.
Still stunning effects. Really good performance with Helen Mack and Robert Armstrong. I love this film.
Robert Armstrong returning to the South Seas, to the isle where Kong came from, and comes upon the actual son of Kong.
Yeah. And you know what, Dan, as you we're saying that people didn't like that movie didn't occur to me because this film and Mighty Joe Young followed King Kong growing up on Thanksgiving. And I, as a kid, I really liked Son of Kong, and I'll admit it, as a kid, better than King Kong.
Well, it's important to also understand that, like, you know, the version of King Kong that a lot of us grew up with was the heavily edited version.
That's
so
right.
You never saw Kong stomping on natives and eating them nervously.
Yeah,
he didn't really understand what a horrific. He just seemed to be like a guy that rescued a girl from some dinosaurs and then they shot him with a plane. It was like, WTF, why are you being mean to Kong? When you finally see the restored version, you understand it's a more nuanced thing. But as a kid, you're just like, Kong is a total victim and you really feel bad for him. Then you watch Son of Kong and your sympathy levels go up, but you're still left like, ah. And finally, the antidote to it all is Mighty Joe Young, which is also on the service, where you finally get a happy ending for the monkey, not to spoil it.
And these films are streaming on Roku and your iPad. in 1080p HD from restored elements. They look great. The creative team that brought King Kong to life, Marion C. Cooper, Ernst Schoedsack, I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, Willis O'Brien, Ruth Rose, they all worked on The Son of Kong. And many of them also returned for Mighty Joe Young, including a very young apprentice who's credited. I shouldn't say apprentice, but he was coming up in the world, a guy named Ray Harryhausen.
Whose name is big.
Although Ray would probably call himself the apprentice to Willis O'Brien.
Yeah, I mean, I think at that point. But Mighty Joe Young is familiar because of the remake, which came out from Disney about 10 years ago. But this is Terry Moore at her Terry Moore-iest. And she's quite a lovely, lovely young lady. And Mighty Joe Young is a very different kind of beast than Kong.
And I might be mixing up my trivia, but doesn't Steve Reeves make a cameo in the rope-pulling scene?
Very likely, because this is around the same time that he won the Mr. Universe pageant.
And if you're friends with Willis O'Brien, you might also want to check out Last Days of Pompeii.
Right, and 1935 RKO epic. That has some amazing special effects because you see the destruction of Pompeii before your eyes.
And all these movies are, you know, if you're of a certain age, are definitely burned into your retinas and your consciousness. But watching Son of Kong in HD, it was kind of fun to see the matting effects.
Oh, yeah.
Because you're really like, why? Because you can see it now, you know, very closely, and that it's actually an incredible achievement, and it's kind of fun. You know,
it sure is.
And I mean, of course, the animated sequences are astounding and hold up.
They did a really amazing job. So it's nice for these films to get their acknowledgement.
I did tear up at the end of Son of Kong watching it again.
I think this is a tribute to Ruth Rose's strength as a screenplay writer. Both Kong and Son of Kong start off just bang from the first clip on. There's no wasted setup. It's like, you know, Son of Kong literally starts pretty much the next day, and he's out.
Oh, yeah. It's a great study in consequences, you know, or consequences. Oh,
there you go.
And by the way, anthropology majors, I understand that Mighty Joe Young is not a monkey. He is a primate.
Matt, your choice for the Oscar.
I have been searching around for romantic comedies because I like laughing and I love love. And also, I love the recent business movies we've been watching. So I found all of those together in the 1963 The Wheeler Dealers with James Garner and
Lee Remick.
Of course, Lee Remick. I'm sorry. Lee Remick and her very, very blue eyes. This was a fun, and you know, because I also recently saw American Hustle, so I'm trying to see like Hustle and Wolf of Wall Street, right?
Right.
And this is the more obviously comedic version of that, but it's the same movie. It's about an out-of-town guy who's trying to, you know, make deals happen and expose hypocrisy, like in modern art and
a little
in the energy
bit of, industry. A little bit of Maverick popping through his
character
there. There
is definitely Maverick, and we've just seen Maverick. So if you like any of those things I said, this is a fun treat.
There are lots of very, very enjoyable 60s romantic comedies which hint at the sexuality that would soon become more prevalent on the screen in subsequent years. Films like Sex and the Single Girl with Henry Fonda, Lauren Bacall, Tony Curtis, and Natalie Wood in the service. And again, streaming in HD as Wheeler Dealers is.
One does have the I have a hotel room on a different floor shtick.
Yeah.
And then, oops, we're right next to each other. I'm now recognizing that as a filmic convention of this time. But that convention is, you know, this is 1963. In 5 years, that's out the window.
Well, I usually pick one of the real oldies in the vault, but I'm picking what I would call a newie, and that is a film from 1981 that I have loved since the day I saw it. And this was filmed in a process that Warner Archive Instant can't perfectly reproduce, unfortunately, because it requires a scratch and sniff card, and that is the process known as Odorama. The film is, of course, John Waters' hysterical comedy, Polyester, from 1981, starring Divine and Tab Hunter, and, of course, the wonderful Edith Massey. Divine plays an unhappy housewife, Francine Fishpaw.
Francine!
Who's being abused by her rotten husband, who's cheating on her, who's being abused by her rotten daughter, who's just a brat, who's being abused by her mother, who treats her awfully. And then suddenly a white knight rolls in a white car.
Oh, yeah.
And it is matinee idol Tab Hunter. And it's really Tab Hunter. This is John Waters moving up in the world.
This is definitely his big debut, I guess.
So, and this is streaming in HD. But there is a prelude to the film in the 1:3:3 aspect ratio before it goes widescreen, where a scientist explains Odorama and the numbers that will be flashing on the screen, and you're supposed to scratch your scratch and sniff card to get an appropriate odor during the making of the watching of the movie. So there are no scratch and sniff cards with Warner Archive Incident. This will not inhibit your enjoyment of the movie. But if you happen to have a pizza or a pair of old sneakers lying around, you might be able to recreate the
effect. Assemble them ahead of time.
The internet is a magical place. You might want to look around. Maybe someone's got an old Odorama card on eBay.
Oh, well, Odorama cards actually came with the DVDs that New Line Home Video prepared. And they were reproductions of the scratches and cards. And I still have at least 25 or 30 of the originals. And they still hold up. The last time I scratched and sniffed them, they still had odor left.
Maybe we should take one of them as like a prize.
You never know.
Or like a giveaway. Or Dan.
The real ones are much bigger.
If someone were to write in, we could maybe send one to them.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. Dan, another thing we could do maybe is prepare a little newsletter article on a few things that, you know, as George was saying, that you assemble before, and we can have them put numbers. Like, you know, get a pair of sneakers, write number two.
These old smelling sneakers.
The home odor.
Yeah,
and then of course there are certain things that we won't mention on the air.
It'll be part of that.
You can duplicate that with eggs.
There you go.
We'll give people tips, and then it's like ahead of time, and it's now. There's a pause button, so you can pause. You know, you can go get one from the refrigerator, bring it back.
But I really also have to call it, Divine's performance in this film is brilliant because. This poor woman, she means well. She wants to be a good wife and mother and daughter, and everybody just treats her terribly. And she's like, why is this happening to me?
And you know, I'm so glad that Divine is now part of the Warner Archive family.
That's right.
That to me is a milestone. And number two, this film is like a great example of where culture was going.
Right.
You know, this is definitely way ahead of its time, sort of appreciated at the time, but as time has gone on, this is where we're at now.
This was the most mainstream he had gone because this film was rated R. It wasn't rated X or
not
underground
rated,
or whatnot. And it's not like Pink Flamingos and Female Trouble and those kinds of films. But it's still a little bit on the racy side, but not something that anyone over the age of 17 can't enjoy.
In high school, I brought a VHS copy of Pink Flamingos to my girlfriend at the Times house, and we're watching it. I'm about 17 years old, and then her mom comes in and yells and screams at me and says, like, get this filth out of my house. And I felt like somehow I had entered a John Waters movie at that moment.
Now, my question to you is, did you go to KFC to bring dinner, you know, or not?
No.
I guess you have to see that movie to understand why that's such a bad joke. In any event, John Waters, polyester starring Divine and Tab Hunter and Edith Massey is now streaming in HD 1080p. On Warner Archive Instant, and that along with hundreds of other wonderful films spanning the 20s to the 90s.
We run the gamut.
And hundreds of hours of television programming, new things always being added, two-week free trial, streaming in HD on your iPad and your Roku, available on your PC and Mac. We're always making refinements and improvements and out to make Warner Archive Instant the destination for streaming for the true film and TV lover who looks for the rare and hard to find.
I know I'm not supposed to clap, but I couldn't help it.
We wrap up, we have to ask the question, Matt, is there a letter this week?
Yes, there is a letter. Thick manila envelope. We've been getting these recently. Why, Dan, have we been getting big, thick manila envelopes recently?
I have no idea, unless there's the secret communications going on in the background and people have figured out if you send me a bigger envelope, I can send you a bigger thing.
Oh, because if you put a self-addressed stamped envelope inside it, you might get something in return?
Yeah, but if you send me a regular stamped self-addressed envelope, it's really hard to jam a DVD in there.
Well, this one comes from Dallas, and I am about to open it. We do not screen these, so whatever you put in here, we read. Well, Dan, when you come back from your secret location, there is, in fact, a large self-addressed stamped envelope and a very small notepad with a nice handwritten letter. Oh, and by the way, if you want to send us a letter...
Where would you send it, Matthew?
Well, send it to Warner Archive Collection, B160-8, 3400 Riverside Drive, Burbank, California, 91522. And you heard us right. We only read real physical letters here. No emails. You have to actually get like a piece of paper and maybe an old piece of charcoal, a burnt stick, a pen, a magic marker, a crayon, and write it, put stamps on it, and send it to us. And here we go. This is from Victoria in Dallas. Dear Warner Archive team, thank you so much for all the hard work you guys put into distributing and restoring all the great classics. I listen to your podcast every month and subscribe to Instant Warner Archive. I think Instant is one of the best things ever, and it has really broadened my horizons when it comes to the types of movies I was willing to watch. If it wasn't for you guys, I don't think I would have seen any of Irwin Allen's productions, and now I am obsessed with the same... See, this is handwriting. Oh, and the same goes to Connie Francis.
Yeah.
Keep up the good work. Connie
That's
Francis.
That's a great
and Irwin
combination.
Allen. That's so great. I do have some questions, though. Will there be any more Betty Hutton films out on DVD? Also, will there be any Sonja Heining films in the future? Again, you guys are amazing and appreciate all the love and care you put into the new releases and restoration projects. Thank you. A big fan, Victoria. P.S. I just bought Eddie Cantor's Kid Millions, and how wonderful was that technicolored ending?
Oh, that's great. Well, Sonja Heining films, we do not have any rights to them. She worked mostly at Fox, and that's where her films lie. So they won't be part of our library. And Betty Hutton, we do have The Miracle of Morgan's Creek available on DVD through the Warner Archive Collection. That's a Paramount movie. There's also Annie Get Your Gun, an MGM film that she did that's available from Warner Home Video. But we don't have any Betty Hutton films planned for the streaming service yet, nor any new Betty Hutton releases for Warner Archive Collection at the moment, although there could be some in the future. It is a possibility.
Oh,
so you never know.
Yeah.
You never know.
All right, we'll keep those letters coming because that's all we have for this week.
Whether they're in crayon or not, we love reading them. We love hearing from you, and we hope you'll continue to look for the Warner Archive Collection podcast each and every week as we announce the new DVDs, Blu-rays, and titles being added to Warner Archive Instant in each weekly podcast. And we'll have a Blu-ray announcement coming up really, really soon.
Oh, yeah, but not now.
So, in any event, thanks for listening to this podcast. I'm George Feltenstein.
I'm Matt Patterson.
I'm Lieutenant Andy Boyle. Doyle.
And on behalf of all the Boyles and Doyles and Goyles, we thank you for listening and look forward to the next Warner Archive Collection podcast.